Hey yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and once again in your ear. I am Martin, and once again I have, as usual, I don't know what to call you today, Brett, the King of the Casters.
Sure.
Mr. Brett Podcast. And Brett, a pleasure for us today because this man is, in our home country, quite iconic.
Oh, that's right. He is truly a Canadian treasure. I mean, he has just been inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. I mean, he started with Max Webster. He has had so many songs that I can sing at any given time. He is Kim Mitchell.
And ruin if you sing them.
Well, I know he's not going to ruin them. Kim Mitchell, how are you?
Hi, guys. Nice to speak with you. How are you doing today? Good?
Fantastic, fantastic. Like I say, okay, honestly, I mean, your songbook, and there's a reason that you've been inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, because your songbook is incredible, and it has been, you know, part of our lives for so many years. Like, just, you know, re-listening to it, it's like visiting old friends.
Well, thanks a lot. You don't see that one coming, the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That really took me by surprise in my life. With Gold Records and Platinum Records and Juno Awards, you kind of sense things coming. I mean, as you're starting to sell records, you go, oh, well, this is almost going gold. Oh, it might go platinum. Oh, it might go double platinum. Oh, and so those are kind of no surprises. But when someone says, can I meet you for a drink at the saloon up the road, and you're like, okay, sure, I'm with SoCan. And they go, we want to induct you into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. You go, what? If someone were to say that to me, who do you think will be inducted next? The last person I would have thought of would be Kim Mitchell and myself. That really, really shocked me. But the first thought that came through my head also was with looking at who's in there, the Neil Youngs and Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen, like, wow, that's a pretty dysfunctional bunch. So, well, when you think about it, you know, those people had they lived a lot of life and had some roadblocks along the way, whether it be, you know, relationships or drugs or all kinds of problems. But that ends up being the fuel for their art. And I don't know too many. I have this little theory that those really happy, positive people, the people who are really positive all the time, they seem to end up in tribute bands. It's the trouble people that end up in, you know, write songwriters. And that's not always the case. I'm just being sort of half humorous and half general, but it takes sort of a little bit of a troubled soul to write songs, I feel. So I thought, okay, I'm going into this club of the dysfunctional songwriters.
Now, I know that you've talked about songwriting as you were essentially being like the shepherd, the roadie of the song as it comes out. So then how has that changed for you since the early days in Max Webster through now, and, you know, especially with Wishes, the new song that, you know, of course, based off the poem?
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. How has what changed?
Well, just how is your songwriting, how has the feeling about songwriting changed over the decades then?
Well, I feel that as you do something more and more, that you become better at it, more comfortable with it, all those things. And I feel back in Max Webster days, the rock and roll training, Max Webster was a very eclectic band that sort of defied category. It was somewhere kind of a mixture of prog rock meets just straight ahead rock and roll with just the most bizarre lyrics. And what made the lyrics bizarre and some of the songs bizarre was the lyrics were made from a person who was an imagist. I don't really call the person, I didn't call Pai Dubois a poet or a lyricist. He was more an imagist. He created pictures on paper. If you go back and listen to any Max Webster song, there's no stories happening. There's not one story. It's all images. And so from that, growing into the formatics of songwriting, you learn about stuff. That's how it sort of started to change. Rick Emmett, a long, long time ago, another Canadian guitar player, songwriter, he sat down with me and went, man, do you know do you know about the formatics of songwriting? Like, do you know what a bridge is and what it's supposed to do? And I'm like, what are you talking about? You're speaking a language I don't even, I just pick up my guitar and start riffing and next thing you know, I'm finished something. He goes, no, there's like parts to a song. And all of a sudden I learned about that. And it's not that you're going to, that's a checklist that's in front of you. Like, is there a chorus? Is there a bridge? Is there a B verse? What is the purpose of all this stuff? Sort of like a technical stuff of songwriting that you can take those and throw them out. Each song is, anyway, I think I've grown as a songwriter, and I'm really proud of the stuff that I've done the past few records, including this one, The Big Fan Aside. I'm seriously proud of it. And I'm not saying I'm not proud of the Max Webster stuff. It had an effect on people, even to this day. Some people are like, when's Max Webster getting back together? I know how Robert Plant feels. And I'm not comparing myself to Robert Plant or Led Zeppelin, but I know people will never stop asking Robert Plant, hey, man, you know, you ever gonna? And he's like, no. You know, in a couple of years, I'll be lucky if I can get across the street without help, you know, let alone go out on tour with Led Zeppelin. He also had a really a lovely comment. See, musicians say things that you pick up and you can sort of hang on to and live your life by. And he said another thing to Paul Rogers, another singer that I so love. Paul Rogers said to him one, he goes, Robert, man, I'm struggling on this tour. I can't hit the high notes anymore. It's just like so weird. And Robert goes, you're not supposed to. Like it's you know, as we age, all, you know, some of these musicians that were popular in the 70s, as we age, you know, there's a certain different kind of thing going to happen. I'm not sure I will ever write another I Am a Wild Party. But actually, having said that, there's a song on the new record called Two Up to Be Down. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now. You got it? What was the question?
Yeah. Well, then I have no idea, but that does bring the way.
It's all good.
That does bring open, you know, the easy question, but, you know, I'm sure everybody wants to know, why a 13-year wait between albums?
Why hurry?
I mean, really, there you go.
What's the hurry? It was just because I was out on the road and having a good time and having some really good years touring, and people are coming out. They want to hear Rock and Roll Duty. They want to hear Logger and Ale. They want to hear Gulf of Soda, Patio Lanterns, a couple deep tracks. They want to hear some Max Webster. I'm fine playing that. Those are all my kids. Like, I don't need to do another record. Recording is hard. Nowadays, it's you finance it yourself. It's a big emotional drain. And I'm good just doing what I'm doing. I'm a happy guy. And it wasn't until Greg Wells, the producer, came along and got the USB key of shame that I gave him with demos on it. And he said, please come to Los Angeles and let's record this in my studio. He said, I love this side of you, sort of the all we are side, the wishes side, the easy to tame, the diamonds. It was more, I mean, I guess more mellow, but he loved that. He said, this side, really, people really need to hear more of this because you do this very well. And so let's do this. So it's his fault.
after 13 years, we thank him.
Me too. Well, now I do too. Once we got going, I mean, he's a very well-known producer now. He was in my band at 17, and he was a Peterborough guy. He lived in Peterborough, Ontario, Reverend Wells' little son, and he ran off to Los Angeles, and boy, oh boy, he had a song on Adele's 21 record. He was producing Katy Perry, Pink, Keith Urban Records, One Republic, OTEP, all kinds of stuff.
So another Canadian boy done good, sorry? Yeah. Another Canadian boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Is he the gentleman that sang on All We Are, All That We Are?
No, that's
Peter Fredette.
Okay.
And Peter came into my life 36 years ago. We've been in the band together ever since, and it's more like family now. It's awesome. He's what I would call, I don't know, what would you call, sort of like he's the edge in U2. He's part of that. He's part of my sound. So, and yeah, he's the guy. You brought that song up, All We Are. I mean, when I wrote that song, he wasn't in the band, and I shelved that tune for a long time. I was like, well, I can sing the verses, but I hear sort of a really high voice, high, beautiful voice, and I even was thinking a female singing it. And then he came along, and I said, do you sing? He goes, yeah, a little bit. I was like, like, whoa, man, you sing, I'll yell. Okay, there's our
yeah, no, his portion is so incredibly beautiful. It's what takes that song to another level. You know, it's the compliments. It's certainly easily among my favorite songs that you've ever done.
I can't tell you the number of times in the 80s and all that stuff after that song that we would play a show and knocks on the dressing room door, and you'd come to the dressing room door, open up the door, and there'd be, you know, couple of female fans, and you're going, oh, all right, and they go, hey, is Peter there? Yeah, separated, hey, Peter. But you know, it's a very talented dude. Shania Twain did that. Shania Twain auditioned him, and he went down to the States to audition for her live band, and when she opened up the studio door, she started singing that song, All We Are, to him. Didn't even say hello. She just went, ask me if I'm still in love. Like, what a compliment.
Absolutely. Well,
yeah.
But, you know, I think it also speaks to you, like, being willing to have a song that showcases someone else as well.
Well, the job as a songwriter for me, or as a musician in my career, what I'm here to do, is simply to serve the song. And that's what I've always tried to do. And anytime musicians ask me for advice, I'm always like, you serve the song. That's your purpose, is to serve the song. It's one thing to be a guitar player, and you practice in your room, and you know how to do this, and you can play fast, or you can play all these cool chords, and you come up with these amazing parts. I don't care. You can use that as long as it's serving the song. Don't make the song about you and your chops. And so that's when Peter came into the band, I realized this is a really good singer here. So I want to use him on this stuff.
Is there other
All We Are? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, sorry. Is there other examples of that, of times where you're like, let's just do what serves the song best, not what serves Kim Mitchell the best?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I learned that as well from a Nashville session guitar player named Tom Bukovet, who I love his playing. And he's one of the A session players, like one of the first calls on these. He's like the big inner circle of the Nashville scene. And he talks about doing session. He goes, oh, I'll have other guitar players and other musicians on there. He says, we can all make our own headphone mix while tracking a song. And he says, I'll check out their headphone mix sometimes, and I'll hear the vocalist buried, and because they're listening to their own playing, so it's accurate and it's kind of vibey and cool parts. He says, I don't. He says, I crank the vocal. He says, everything I do is a reaction to the vocal and the song, the emotion. The vocal might, the person might sing a little bit behind and really quiet in this part. And he says, I just react off that. And that's probably why he's one of the most called upon guitar players in Nashville.
Yeah, it's always so interesting to hear the stories about how other people work, because I mean there must be so many things that you've learned, you know, from other people. I mean, you talk about Rick Emmett, and then you talk about this. I mean, you know, so much stuff that you've learned over the years, and that's a big part of the reason why going into the, you know, Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you, and you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm not sure if anyone's learned anything from me, but I sure have learned a lot from them, from a lot of people, whether they be famous bands we're opening for, or whether it's just a guitar player on a Sunday afternoon at a pub. There's always something that if you open your eyes and open your ears and open your heart, you're going to learn from another musician. And on something to do or something not to do, something that would is working for them but wouldn't work for you, or something that would might work for you. You know, with Rush, we toured with Rush a lot. I learned that there's all this outside pressure from the biz, record companies, and people who want to sell your music, that we need this kind of stuff. We want you to write this kind of thing. It's like, no, Rush, we're like, no, this is our lives. We're pals. This is our thing here. This is our music. And you can all, you know, go off somewhere else because we're not even listening to you. So this is our life and our music. And they taught me another thing, that record companies and managers and all that stuff and publishers, they start to get this idea. And this isn't me being bitter. This is just observing what's going on. You get the feeling that promoters and all that stuff, people who book the shows, you're working for them. But in fact, it's the other way around. They're all working for you. It's your music. Without your music, they don't have a job. So, you know, I learned that from Rush, and I thought it was a really healthy thing to adopt, that you walk through your life and your music career with confidence and not arrogance, but just confidence and sure-footed. And when you want something, you ask for it and make sure you get it, at least to try. Bryan Adams was like that. Played with Bryan Adams. I watched him calling light scenes during a sound check. Like, no, I want to go over this lighting scene for this song. See that? No, I don't want that. Do something else here. More magenta, more of this. And I'm sitting out front watching the sound check and going, here's a guy who's running his show.
Well, yeah, I mean, so interesting. Mo, you had a question?
Yeah, no, I just, no, actually, less of a question, more of a compliment. You humbly deflect as in typical Canadian manner, but to give you a big compliment, for me, I always viewed you as Canada's version of Tom Petty, and that's how I would describe you to people from, you know, from other countries and whatever, when I would talk to them about you and your music. And, you know, that's why it doesn't surprise me to see you in the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you. As I said, that was a real surprise for me. And, of course, a humbling experience. Because my head is down most of the time, and I'm just doing something for humankind, which my job is to take you away to Rockland Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And so I'm writing songs, I'm playing live, and to look up once in a while and go, what? You're doing this for me? That's amazing. It's kind of beyond words for me that how amazing it feels to get that.
You know, I think for a lot of us, supporting you and buying your albums and going to your concerts for a long time, it felt like supporting Canada itself. You know, you were such a Canadian. In Canada, you so represented us to each other, I think, very well. How do you feel about the support?
Across the country. Man, I've crossed the country over 40 times. So, yeah. I've been to all these cities, and I like to include, when I think of my music, when I'm playing my music, when I'm writing it, I like to include the audience and the people who I've been around and people I've met and people who have been in the audience. I think, you know, it's a funny thing what you said. I feel, and I've said this often, I feel like any one of the audience members I could hang out with for a weekend, and we'd just be a couple of peeps hanging out, you know, a couple of Canadians hanging out, saying sorry to each other and stuff like that. That's the first thing. I mean, Greg Wells, a producer in Los Angeles, he's a former Canadian, and he was reminded right away. He said, because I would say, oh, I'm really sorry, I could have played that a little better. He goes, let me be the insecure Canadian here, Ken. He says, you're doing fine. He said, because it's really different. He says, when I work with Canadians, it is very much like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't play that right. He says, where Americans are like, hey, check that out. Isn't it great? That's awesome, huh? So it's just, it really is a different vibe working with them.
As somebody who's crossed the country 40 plus times, then is that, do you think, because I mean, obviously you have such a vast country and within that, such, you know, different cultures, but the unifying factor of Canada, do you think a lot of that is that humbleness?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's in all of us. I think, yeah. I can't say I've met people that I don't dig in this country. The only time I may have been put off is if they're really drunk and slobbering all over me, but that was a brief moment. And other than that, people are, everyone I've met, I love Canadians. They're all really cool and cool to hang out with. And I'd go camping with you. I'd ride in a pickup truck with you. I'd go boating with you. I'd fly in airplanes with you. We talk in airports. We meet in hotels. I'm downtown somewhere, whether it be wherever across Canada. And hey, how you doing? After a show, we're in the saloon together sometimes, having a drink together. That's great.
And
it's
you know
a
what?
Wonderful life, man. Yeah, go ahead.
If they're drunk and slobbering all over you, do you tell them to go for a soda?
No. Because you know why? Because I've been like that too. So, no, you just put up with it, you know, unless it's getting stupid. But I mean, I don't like to say this, but I always have someone watching out for me, you know, who's usually around and they're my road manager or something. And if things start to get kind of silly, which they rarely do once in a while, I can only think of one time where someone had to be removed from a situation. So other than that, it's just like, hey, man, it's okay. You know, don't worry about it, man. You know, really thanks a lot for saying hi and, you know, all good.
Well, I mean, and when you talk about going across country so many times, I mean, you know, a big part of that is your interactions with the fans. And I know that they're numerous. I mean, just looking at your Twitter feed and stuff like that. But also your onstage persona is just so much fun that I know seeing you live is a great experience.
Well, I mean, that's the place where it all happens for me. That's where all my, I guess what I prepare for every day and every year, pretty much. Whatever I do, the end result is walking on stage and taking an audience away to Rockland Wonderland. And so I have fun with it. When you say it's a fun experience, well, it is. Playing music is fun. And when you get up there, you can't take it too seriously. You know, it's just it's got to be fun and playful. You're with these other musicians, and you're transmitting an energy together, and you're trying to connect on a musical level. And you know, when you do, that the audience picks up on that and feeds off of it. That's that sort of intangible, that untouchable thing. It's like, how does an audience start reacting? Well, the audience starts reacting because there's an energy coming from the stage. And I don't mean an energy that's, I'm talking about a musical energy. I'm not talking about lasers and pyrotechnics and singers jumping up and down and stuff flying around. I'm talking about what's coming out of the speakers. There's an energy and a vibe that these musicians are connecting with. And that's a beautiful thing.
That's
what makes it fun.
The new single, or the first single, Wishes, from the new album, The Big Fantasize. I understand it's very representative of the type of sound we're going to hear in the album. So just go into a little more depth on the album, the sound, and the songs in it.
Sure. Well, along the whole career, I've always had a fondness for the party tunes. But I also really enjoy writing deeper stuff, more cosmic, more laid back, more atmospheric stuff. And I'll give you an example as All We Are. It's kind of an atmospheric, slower, vibey thing, but there's still an intensity to it. And I love writing that stuff. And over a few years, I had a bunch of that stuff between the time of my last record, Ain't Life Amazing, and now. I was writing a bit more in that vein. And I'm not sure why. It was just the feeling that I had. Is it because I'm getting older? Is it because I just nothing like I'm a wild party's coming to me? I don't ask the questions. I just get on the song and start to write it. and take it to its natural conclusion. And then I had, so this was all built up. So, and Greg wanted to focus on these songs. He thought this was a nice vibe. So it is a little more atmospheric. Lyrically, I love it. I love the content, lyrical content on this album. And I know that doesn't play a huge role in people's lives, but there's a song on it called Old Marriage Waltz that it's just about just a look at a couple that are just in shambles at the end of their marriage. And it's just a beautiful lyric. And Wishes is a gorgeous lyric from a poem by A.C. Child, who I don't even know who A.C. Child was. It's public domain. I'm thinking the poem was written maybe in the 40s, but we don't know. We've done so much work trying to find who this person was and kind of keep coming up with nothing other than it's public domain, which means that person doesn't exist anymore. So whether or not they're not alive. There's another song, I guess the closest to a party tune, fast tune, a couple songs, Kick Along. And one of them is called Two Up to Be Down. And it'll be a single, beautiful lyric again. Come down to my summer town. We won't let you down. We can't make a frown. We're too up to be down. Skies dressed up in rainbow ties. Try the softer side. You'll never want to die because we're too up to be down. So just a real playful signature Kim Mitchell rock tune. And then there's another song on it, Georgian Bay. It kicks along with a five-piece horn section, which I've never worked with. And it was just so much fun doing that. And along with Greg Wells, who produces, he's such a well-respected mix engineer in Los Angeles now. I mean, he hangs out with like Quincy Jones and people like this. And they all just love him. And he has his own studio that over 20, 25 years, he's accumulated all this specialized gear that, you know what it's like, you collect this and you collect this, and next thing you know, you kind of have your sound going and it's becoming popular or it's doing really well and making great sounding records. Sonically, I love the sound of the record. And so I hope that sort of helps you a little bit. It's kind of hard to describe, but
Well, absolutely. I mean, what kind of anticipation for do you have as you build up to the release of an album like this? What is your kind of, what kind of feelings does it, you know, bring up in you knowing that this is about to come out?
Well, there's two things. That's a good question. First of all, my journey with this record is over. My journey of the recording process is the recording process. It's the writing, it's the recording, it's the agonizing over. And once that's done, once it's mixed, once it's mastered, and it's all finished and there's nothing left to do, my journey is done with it. So what lies ahead for me is in anticipation is, excuse me, I can only hope that whoever hears it, however small an audience or however big an audience is, they like it. But I know that I have no control over any of that. So I somewhat, I guess I only hope that they like it. I don't have any expectations. This business is wacky. I'm an older dude, and I realize that the majority of sales in the record business is geared towards much, much younger people than I. But at the same time, I still have an audience, and I hope they dig the record. I hope they dig the song. So far, the feedback on the song has been amazing. Maybe it has to do with because of the pandemic we're living in, too, and the lyrical content of it. Because, it's talking about wish and some of the things that we wish for, or different people wish for. And then there's a lot simpler things we can be wishing for, too. And hopefully you at least get granted those things before you die.
I think the thing is that it's 13 years since your last release, and it's, I think, since I first saw Might As Well Go For A Soda on CBC Switchback and when I was, like 11.
Wow, you just blew my mind with a memory, man.
Switchback, yeah. That song made an impression on me, right? That's where I saw it, was on Switchback on
very
CBC.
Very impressive.
On a Sunday morning, and it made that impression. it's, you know, since then I'm older. So the idea that, you're, you know, exploring these things, and I think why it's going to be, you know, you'd find such a receptive audience is because we, you know, if you are the way you view the world and your life experiences should reflect ours. And I think it sounds like they do.
Yeah, they do. Because that sort of goes back to, I like to include my audience in my work. So hopefully we all kind of on this same track. You know what impresses me actually is the younger audience when I play our shows, outdoor festivals and stuff, and see younger people who, when I was in Max Webster or something, they would probably just be being born, if that. And there they are. They're rocking out to my band and the music, and they're vocal, very vocal sometimes, you know, coming backstage and saying, "Oh man, that was great." It's like, it's so cool. And it's neat how that sort of says to me that some songs have staying power. It crosses generations. And so that's another thing that humbles me in my work.
So this brings up an interesting question that popped in my head here. What are the three things that Kim Mitchell most values in this world?
Well, I mean, the three things I value, I guess, would be love and health and love in my family, I guess, yeah. And let's include my dog Webster in there.
Your dog's name is Webster. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, he was a rescue. He came as that. So you know when you say, "Oh, so what's the dog's name?" And they say it's Webster. It's like, okay, see you, Webster. I'm leading you. No, I had to take him at that point. I value all kinds of things. I value each and every day that I am able to get up and enjoy the moment and enjoy the good earth. And that's an ongoing. I hate to say it like this, but it's like a moving target. I'm always appreciating, and certain things change. What are important to me? Sometimes it's important, you know, as we go through life, different things are important. Like getting out of an unhealthy relationship becomes very important. Getting into a healthy relationship is important. When you haven't seen your children, that becomes important. Okay, I gotta maintain, you know, I need to see my kids. Sometimes your health is sliding. I had a major health scare a few years back, so that becomes very important. So, but that was a good question.
Well, and it brings up a follow-up question that, as I asked it, I thought of, and that's just those things, you know, love, family, and the things that you listed. What do you think then are the best songs about those things that you value, that either by yourself or by anybody else?
Good songs that are about that?
About the things that you value the most, yeah.
Well, that's a tough question. It's kind of hard to be put on the spot because there's millions and millions of songs out there. That's a tough one. I don't think I can answer that.
Okay.
I think you've stumped me. Good job.
I wasn't trying to do that.
No, I know you weren't trying. I know you were trying. You're basically talking about songs that I listen to that sort of hang a little bit of a thing on that goes, yeah, I like to live by that a little bit. There's a bunch of songs. This might sound like a weird choice, but no, I'm not even going to say it. Well, I'll say it. Human. We're only human. You know, the song by Human. I love that refrain. You know, we're only human, born to make mistakes. And it's true. It's true. And I'd love to see us understand that better and be kinder. And that would be my hope moving forward. That we,
Sorry, you probably caught me at an introspective time. That's why I'm asking these type of questions. I've been trying to figure out what the best songs to represent friendship are. You know, because it's something I value so much. And it was just, yesterday thinking, what are those songs? And so, So I didn't mean to put you on the spot. You know,
and what did you come up with?
There's quite a few, you know, Stand By Me by Bill Withers, certainly. Sure. Or no, sorry, Lean On Me, sorry, by Bill Withers.
Okay, Lean On Me, yep, very good.
Yeah. Yep. Thank You, Friends by Big Star.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I'll Be There by the Jackson 5.
Sure.
You know, these are songs that to me are very representative of friendship, and friends are, you know, friends are one of the three things I value the most. So,
I would include that too. And you had me on the spot there, but yeah, friends, I value my two friends a lot.
Yeah, I value my friends except for Brett.
Yeah.
Well, when you think about it, does anybody have like a? I mean, when people talk about social media friends, they're usually people you haven't met. So friends really are the people that you really would do anything for, and they would do anything for you. And you really, that's right. That's a good thing to value. That's strong, because they'll be there when your marriage breaks up or bad stuff happens, or, you know, they're there for you. So
I'm interested because, you know, I mean, all this talk about songs and of course your time on the radio, was it ever like, how did you feel like programming in your own songs?
Well, I didn't program them in. That's the show was done. The show was always done whenever I went in. And I think listeners need to know that when they're hearing a radio show, it's basically a computer that is kind of suggesting these songs haven't been played at this time and haven't played. So it's actually, there's a program doing it. And then a music director who has that role adjusts it because, oh, well, the morning show played that song earlier, and this person took liberties and played it because something was going on. So I never programmed one of my songs ever. It was all part of CanCon. And near the end of my radio career, I asked the music director, I said, please take my stuff out. I said, because every time one of my songs plays, I get hate email that I'm playing my own music. It's like, dude, quit playing. You're disgusting. Well, it's like... And you can't say to the listener, man, I'm not doing this. It's done. We're playing this song because it's Canadian content. We have to play it by law. And they just played Lover Boy, and they just played April Wine, and they just played this. And the only thing left to play right now is a Kim Mitchell track. So are there bigger things going on in the world right now than you writing into me, giving me a heck about, you know, a song that's 3 minutes long?
Well, that was why I asked, because I know, of course, about the CanCon rules and Kim Mitchell, such a big part of CanCon. So, you know, how could you avoid yourself in that regard? But no, and I'm also really interested. You talked about the early days and just how difficult it was to learn the radio business. And I mean, I guess, you know, knowing you as you are on stage and stuff like that, it almost doesn't compute that it would be hard. It's just like you talking should be a natural.
And in addition to that, is I was thinking a similar thing, just because recently we've also interviewed Ron Keel and Michael DeBar, and they're both radio hosts as well or, you know, musicians. And just why is it that this is, you know, the musicians transition well to the radio?
Oh, they transitioned well, did they?
they did, yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
You did it for 11 years, didn't you?
I did it for 11 years, and I respect the craft. So I have so much respect for the craft now, and your listeners need to know that. I say this anytime I bring up my time in radio, that there's a craft. To do anything well, you have to work hard at it, and it's the same with broadcasting, if not more. More so, it might sound easy that you just open up a microphone and start talking, but it's not. It's not easy to be engaging, to be in the moment, and basically you're in creative sales. Well, there's a lot of times you're selling stuff, and it can't sound like you're selling stuff, and you have to have fun, and there's just so much going on, and yet there's the formatics of what's actually happening during an hour. So, and try not to use radio-isms like, yeah, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to, like, all that sort of radio jive talk that people are like, what? Why do you even say that stuff? And learning that's a whole pile of stuff that you learn along the way. And boy, I sucked. And I think we all suck when we start something new that we've never done before. It's just in radio, everyone could hear me suck. And they reminded me by the hour for the first year. It was like, it was brutal. At 4 months, I went into my boss and went, I don't think I could do this. He goes, why don't you think you can do it? I said, because, you know, getting like 100 emails a day, just like it's hard to read that stuff. He goes, just forget it. Just don't even look at that stuff. He says, they're dickweeds. And I was like, well, no, they're not your listeners. They're your listeners. And he goes, well, don't pay any attention to them. Just delete, 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 delete. So they just want a reaction out of you. And he says, I think you got something, and give it another year. And if you don't have it then go ahead and leave. And he worked with me really. He really believed in me and my boss, and we worked hard. And eventually, listeners started to come around, and the program got really popular. So.
Well, I mean, it must be just...
Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, it must be just like playing live, you know, and you create your persona on stage, and just like this, you have to create your own persona on the radio and find that voice.
Well, that's an interesting take you just mentioned, because that for me the interesting part was being who I am. How do I get to be who I am without how do I get to that point where I'm just myself on the radio? That's a hard thing to do. You're talking into a microphone and just be yourself and with some confidence and just your personality. Like, you have a personality on the radio that people want to bring you. When you're at home, you have some kind of thing. You might be a humorous guy over, you know, talking about this or that or certain things you say, and that's what makes you special. So how do you get that into radio? I thought that was the hardest thing to do, because you're all of a sudden the microphone comes on, the red lights on. It's like, okay, that was, you know, rather than just like, hey man, what a cool tune, huh? What about that middle section? Like, what were they thinking? You know, like, should they work on the lyrics a bit more on that one? Or, you know, I don't know, just sort of trying to be yourself.
Yeah.
But I loved it because, okay, so anyway, just like to wrap it up, what I loved about my radio career the most was being able to put on headphones and rediscover the music that I grew up with. When I was growing up, you're sort of paying attention to the music, and it's a big deal in your life, but it wasn't like you're putting on headphones all the time. And when I had the headphones on for 11 years, I'm going, wow, I never heard that part. It's like, it was blowing my mind every day. It's like heart songs were great and everything. But when I had the headphones, I'm like, wow, these albums are recorded so amazing. They're just plowing along. Sonically sounds so great. April Wine, it's make great sounding records. Obviously, Led Zeppelin, geez, like just it's just like a cosmic vibe tsunami of you know, it's like it's amazing, every tune.
So do you remember that the very first show you played live, and the feeling, how many people were there and that type of thing, and how did it compare to the first day on the radio?
Probably about the same. I mean, I didn't know. I was playing my first gig. Was probably I was 12 years old, I think 12 or 13. I was in a band, and I was playing bass guitar on a six string. I was the bass player, because they didn't have a bass player. So, but I didn't have a bass. All I had was a guitar. So I'm playing like just the low string on my guitar, and it was terrible. It was disgusting. I had a brush cut, and it was horrible. So, yeah, I guess the same thing. The first day on the radio, I'm sure people were going, whoa, why did they do this? What were they thinking when they signed Kim Mitchell to this radio station? But they thought it was a good fit. So,
and it turned out it was.
It ended up being a good fit. Yeah, look.
How about that first band? How about the first time that you got together with the members of Max Webster? When did you feel that there was something there that, you know, would be, I don't know, have a little bit more extra than what you had before?
It took a while. I had moved back from the Greek island of Rhodes, was living there. And Mike Tilka, the bass player, and I had contacted him through someone else I knew, and it was, I heard that he wanted to move to Toronto. He was in Windsor, Ontario, and he wanted to move to Toronto and start a band. And so I got a hold of him, and we got a place, we got a house, and we got another drummer. We got a drummer, Paul Kersey, and just sort of started to rehearse. And right away, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. It really wasn't gelling. It wasn't really happening for me yet. It wasn't inspiring, but it was, I sort of like, well, we got to make this work, because like, we have rent to pay, and we got to get gigs. So we learned a bunch of cover tunes, and the singing part was a weird thing, because I'm just standing there playing a bunch of cover tunes, Suffragette City and all this stuff, and Mike Tilka, the bass player, singing it, and he's sounding okay, but not like, I'm like, oh. And then even he went, I don't feel like singing this stuff. Who else sings in the band? Can anybody else sing in the band? And they kind of looked at me and went, Kim, why don't you try singing it once? I'm like, ugh. do I have to? I just want to stand here and play guitar. And so I did, and they ended up liking it. And then from there, we tried a couple original songs that I had written. And then it sort of started to light up. Things started to light up a little bit, and I started to get a little bit inspired. But Max Webster started simply out of me wanting to take guitar lessons from a specific teacher in Toronto. I wanted to take lessons from this guy, and I needed to make some money. So, well, we got to start a band. So, and then I sort of knew things were starting to happen when we were playing our gigs and audiences started to come to these bars. It's like, okay. And then it'd be like, holy smokes, there's a lineup outside. What's going on? And people were really digging it. And I'm like, okay, so let's just keep doing what we're doing.
Nice. Now, is the band that you're working with for the new album the same as Ain't Life Amazing? Or, you know, who is it?
Okay, well, the band is me. It's Greg Wells. It's a session bass player. There's horn players. There's different keyboard players. Including my band, Peter Fredette's on it, but there's other singers too. I mentioned it earlier, a song called Old Mary's Waltz. I'm singing with a female, beautiful, talented female woman named Laura Cole. Has a real Southern vibe to her voice. I just love the sound of her voice. And we blend well. So it's kind of a mishmash of, I sort of, once again, served the song and went, what do I hear here? So it wasn't so much, I need to have my band on this. It was more like, what would be the right thing here to serve this song? So that's kind of, it's kind of go by your gut feeling. Greg Wells, once again, you can sick of hearing his name, but he's probably the best drummer I've ever played with. And so he's playing most of the drums on the record, except on the song Wishes. A gentleman by the name of Guy Peck is playing on that. And I never met Guy. He was in a studio with a friend of mine, and I said, I need a drum track really quick, because I got this song, it's done, and here's what I want to play. So do you know somebody? He goes, yeah. He says, I'll get Guy. He'll throw down the drums on this little demo for you. And I'm like, okay, great. And that's what I used. And he went back to, I think, what was his home? Somewhere in Europe. And I never got to even meet him.
Even the music video for Wishes is quite personal, and the vibe that it gives off. How much of that is you, and how much of that is the director, and what is what's the process of making that video? And videos in 2020, I'm sure as well, it's got to be way different than making the video for Might As Well Go For A Soda or Patio Lanterns.
It's a completely different thing. Go For A Soda, yeah. Those things are like crews and lighting everywhere. I shot a lot of this, and then I got shots from a friend of mine, high definition shots. Some of the shots are from Africa. It's a good friend of mine. She's from Kenya, and she was showing me shots of her safari camps and stuff like that. And I said, ooh, can I use some of this stuff? I can, I'll pay you for it. She goes, no. I was like, just go ahead and use it. Use whatever shots you want. So some of the stuff is that, and then some of it's just me riding around in my car with the camera facing up into the sky. So you sort of get the shot through the sunroof, and and you sort of see my head in it. And then some of it's in my basement studio where I do my vocals. And so I directed it with a guy named Darren Bristow, who I love working with. So we connect on a level. So that's kind of the process. It's all sort of just a mishmash of stuff without the big crews and the big expenses.
Yeah, it's so interesting now. I mean, just the music industry has changed so much, and of course you've seen so many of those changes. Do you think it's better now, or is it, you know, worse or just different?
I think it's, I'm not going to make a comment on do I think it's worse. It's not worse. It's different, and it's supposed to be different. I love the fact that it's different. I think from every generation and every decade, people change and say things differently in all different cultures and different places in the world and different generations from, you know, think about the difference of the big band era of the 40s and then spool ahead to EDM music and how, what a massive difference that is. And you're like, oh, wow, it's just a computer. It's just like, well, yeah, it's done by a computer, and it may not be my favorite style of music. And after 15 minutes, at times it may get on my nerves. But at the same time, it's a generation speaking in the language that they want to speak in. And that's always going to be the case. And that's you have to have that. And that's a beautiful part. As long as it, you know, creativity will always be, it's always going to be there, and there's going to be creative people, whether they're sitting in front of a piano or whether they're sitting in front of a computer. It's as Neil Peart said in Rush, all this modern machinery making modern music can still be open-hearted. So I love that it changes. I love hearing the new stuff. I love to hear a younger generation and how they speak, and, you know, with hip hop and stuff, it's just a different, totally different, cool language. And, that's supposed to happen. And, you know, 50, 60, 100 years from now, it'll all be, the whole language will be different again. So who knows what it'll be, right?
Do you even know what your most expensive music video ever was? And did you ever have any music videos or promotions brought to you that made you go, what the hell is this?
I mean, I was back in the days of videos when I first started to do that stuff. I wasn't a fan of doing that. I'm sort of bucked that whole thing. I was like, man, songs are, you're supposed to make up your own pictures in your head. It's like, that's what music's all about. Why are we doing pictures? Like, you know, yeah, I was like a curmudgeon old dude, but I just didn't, you know, I was in the game of music, making notes and creating pictures through my guitar playing and my singing and my songs. So I couldn't really relate to videos. So I was kind of uncomfortable and awkward through all of them. And they all cost money. Go for Soda did not cost a lot of money. It was early technology that they were experimenting with, superimposing us into a fridge. So, you know, they cut us a deal. I think Rock and Roll Duty cost us a bit of dough because that was done at a location. And, you know, there's a lot of crew. There's things going on and lighting and up. They turned out okay, but boy, yeah. Sometimes it'd be like the storyboard would come in and go, oh, no, you don't want me to do that. But you kind of try it. And then you kind of cringe for the rest of your life over it. You know, so
I guess it does tend to follow you around.
If you want to know what makes me cringe, my album covers make me cringe. If I could go back and redo anything over again, it would be the cover of High Class and Borrowed Shoes and Universal Juveniles. I would redo those. And probably Itch. I'm called Itch, which I'm very proud of musically, but... yeah, I don't know, the label I was with, it's just like, what, you think that should be the cover? Oh, my God, really? Anyway.
Universal Juveniles does stand out as a very odd cover, yes.
Yeah, it's totally odd, yeah. It's those High Class and Borrowed Shoes, it's just, you know. But Well, bands were wearing weird stuff, so that was a combination. It was a combination of Captain Beefheart and I don't know, some kind of glam rock thing. I don't know.
Oh well, it definitely was of a time, but
sure,
Kim. You know, well, I know we're
can't. Yeah.
Oh no, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say we're running out of our time with you, and so
that's fine.
We've had such a great time.
Pleasure speaking to you.
So please tell everybody where they can find Kim Mitchell, and of course, when the Big Fantasize comes out, tell them where they can find that and the new song Wishes.
Sure. Well, Wishes is online. It's on YouTube. You can go to kimmitchell.ca, or you can find it on all your, streaming services: Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, and I hope you enjoyed the single. I'm really proud of it. It really reaches deep within, so I hope it does with a few others.
Well,
and it was really nice speaking with you guys.
I love the single. We love talking to you. I know that Kim Mitchell music is going to be a mainstay in our life for the rest of our life. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, thanks.
Wait, does that you naked on the back on Adios Amigos? Just looking at the album covers now and going, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, don't look at the covers. I repeat, step away from the ledge. Step away from the ledge. All right, guys, see you later.
All right, thanks Kim. Much. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Some may wish for city streets, jewels or silken gown. Some may crave unbounded wealth, fame or beauty's crown. Some may long for sunny paths that lure the pleasures bent. Simpler things by far than these would keep my soul content. These are the things that I wish for. These are the things I wish for. These are the things that I wish for you and me. Give me God's green countryside with blue skies overhead, a tiny shack, white curtain on my silver flower. Set for supper time, fresh fruit and honeycomb, and a warm breeze that's whispering that your baby's coming home. Simple things with love and faith, far from worldly strife. Grant me these before I'll ask no more of life. are the things I'll wish for. These are the things that I wish for you and me. These are the things that I wish for. These are the things I wish for. These are the things that I wish for you and me.